Welcome to this episode of Out of the Best Books, the podcast where we deep dive into classic literature and have conversations about what we've learned and discovered along the way. We love all things books and reading, and we want to share our love of the classics with you. We hope to inspire you to read along with us and join in the conversation. I'm Laura.
And I'm Amity. Let's get started.
I might have confessed to this a couple weeks ago, but I have read Jane Eyre. I've read 75% of Jane Eyre like three times.
This time, I have to finish it.
Yeah, I have to. Yeah. I don't know what happens. I get 75% if I just like lose. It's really long, but like, did I just lose interest? I don't know. Lost the book. Really quick, I wanted to just give a little introduction to Charlotte Bronte. It's her life was fascinating. Do you know much about it?
I don't. Other than so, there were the three sisters, right?
There was actually six kids.
Oh, okay. But there's the three that are the authors, which is kind of incredible. And especially that three girls from one family are so well known and loved and remembered, you know, Charlotte, yes. Anne, and Emily. So, okay, go ahead.
Okay. So she was born in April of 1816, and she was actually the third of six children. So her mother died of cancer when she was five.
Oh, wow.
So the youngest, Anne Bronte, was just 2 years old when her mom died. So her mother's sister kind of helped raise them a little bit. Their father never remarried. And originally, Jane Eyre was called like an autobiography. Isn't that
really?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
I just thought that was kind of interesting. When you look at all of these, the parts of the story of Jane Eyre, she experienced a lot of it. When the kids were young, so she had two older sisters and then her and Emily, they were all sent to a charity school that was similar to Lowood.
Oh my gosh, I did not know this.
And this is awful. Her two older sisters died of tuberculosis at the school. So immediately their dad brought her and Emily home and decided to school them at home. At home, there was four kids left, Charlotte, Emily, Anne, and then they had one brother named Branwell. And he ended up kind of being a mess. He was an alcoholic. He had an affair with
his name was Branwell.
Yeah.
Okay, there's your first issue. Sorry, he had an affair with who?
He was tutoring a boy. Okay, so Anne was like a, what do they call it? But Jane goes and does. Governess.
Anne,
governess. Got Branwell a job in the house, and he supposedly had an affair with the woman of the house.
Oh, okay.
They're not really sure if it was like if she, I don't know, if he just had like a obsession with her or if it was consensual or whatever, because the father just blamed him.
Oh, that's interesting, because I feel like usually it's the woman who gets blamed.
Yeah. At home, when they were being schooled at home, they would write poetry and like stories. They had these worlds that they had created. And so Charlotte and Branwell had this imaginary world. And then Emily and Anne also had this imaginary world that they were working on. And they published their stuff in something called Branwell's Blackwell's magazine. So they had their own little publishing company that they did. Charlotte came across something that Anne wrote, a poem, and she was like, we need to publish this. And Anne was like, no. And so they convinced her that if they all three contributed to this book that they were going to publish, that they would do it. And so they published it, and they only sold two copies. I thought that was kind of funny.
Everybody has to have their failure, I guess.
Yes. They published it under the names of Currer, Ellis, and Action Bell. So they were like gender neutral names and not themselves. Yeah.
Who knows what those names even are?
I know, Currer. And then eventually people did figure out who the actual authors were. They never told their brother that they were published authors, because they were worried that he would be upset at their success, because he was such a failure.
Yeah, that would be pretty typical of the time for sure.
So he ended up dying of tuberculosis.
Oh my gosh.
I think it was because his alcoholism covered it up for too long, and then it was too late.
Oh, so
he died, okay. And then her sisters died of tuberculosis also. So she was the only child.
Three? Wow.
So five of the six kids died from tuberculosis.
Of TB.
They also think that it could have had something to do with the water in the city. Mm. Like it was contaminated or something, because it was a big, people were just dying left and right.
You may have already said this, but where did she fall in the lineup of kids?
She was third.
So Anne and Emily were the two older?
No.
No, they must not have been.
They were younger. I don't know
they
what
were younger.
I don't know what the girls' names were. I think Branwell was either next to, like, just younger than Charlotte, or it went Charlotte, Emily, and then him. But I know Anne was the youngest.
Okay.
And then the last thing is she eventually married in 1854, and then she died in 1855. She was pregnant. And
my gosh.
They think it was like excessive morning sickness. So she got extremely dehydrated, and that's how she died.
Oh, wow. It makes
And
you wonder.
She was 39.
And she got married at 39.
Like
And
38.
That was her first time getting married. Wow. Interesting.
She had a couple of other suitors, and she actually, at one of the schools she was at, she had an obsession with her like teacher who was married.
Okay.
That was kind of an issue. They don't really know if it was, again, if he returned it or if she was just obsessed with him. But he would go through these time periods where he would like encourage it, and then he would squash it and then encourage it. Then nothing
hot
ever
and
happened.
Cold. And for a young girl, that's very difficult. I blame him.
Yeah. But they have letters too that she wrote to him, and his wife actually, like, he ripped them up and she stitched them back together, and they don't know why she stitched them back together. Like, if she was trying to like have evidence or
blackmail,
I don't know. Her life was fascinating. I would love to read a whole
I didn't know any of that
biography.
That is super interesting.
Yeah, like I said, she died in 1855, so she didn't live very long. I love people's lives.
They're very fascinating.
I don't think fiction writers can come up with stuff as good as real life.
No. That suddenly makes me, has anybody written a book about her? Like a fun book? I always want, maybe we could co-author a book about Charlotte Bronte.
Well, I know there's a book about her being a vampire.
Oh,
or
okay.
something.
Like what?
Or a serial. There's one about her being a serial killer. There's some interesting literature about her. Her neighbor, Elizabeth Glaskell, is the one that wrote her biography, like after she died.
Okay.
And
I was going to say, I'm sure there's biographies about her.
I bet you there's plenty of not like fiction about her too, because her life is extremely
it is
interesting.
Super interesting. I just don't know of any. So
anyways, so I'm excited about this. It'll be.
So remember the names of the authors of the first books that they published?
Yes. Currer.
There's a note to the third edition of Jane Eyre on this part that I have. It was written in April 13th, 1848 by Currer Bell. So there you go.
Oh, another interesting thing. They had a grandfather that met a young orphan and like brought him in and raised him as his own. And the rest of the kids were super jealous of them. Wuthering Heights.
Yeah. That's well, and it does make you see why their books are so dark. Their life was pretty dark. Hold on though. What was the name of the other, what was the other pen name?
Ellis and Action.
Action Ellis.
It was Kerr, Ellis, Action, Bell. So the three words, and then their last name was Bell. Kerr, Ellis, and Action Bell.
Okay, so Charlotte, Emily, and Anne.
Yes, they were, and they used their first letters.
And
Yes.
B for Bronte, or Bell for Bronte.
Yep.
That took me a minute to put together, but we got there. Okay. I'm like, oh, that's so cool. You're like, yeah.
No, I didn't even think of it. I mean, maybe I did when I was reading about it and they said it, but I forgot. But they didn't, you know, they used gender neutral names. They didn't want people to know they were women. Well, let's dive right in, because I really, really, really enjoyed reading these first few chapters. It wasn't as hard of work as Much Ado About Nothing. So that was kind of nice.
No, the flow of the writing of this is just, it is very easy.
Occasionally, I kind of don't know what she's saying, but
it's
easy to just kind of go on and then like you'll get it.
Yeah. Sometimes it's all about placing it in the context of the entire story and then you get what's happening. Okay.
Yes. Okay. So in chapter one, so in the beginning of the book, we learn that there's this young girl named Jane Eyre, and she lives at Gateshead with her wealthy relatives, the Reed family. Ugh. I was watching the beginning of the movie, one of the movies the other day, and I was like, oh my gosh.
Speaking of which, there are a lot of Jane Eyre movies, I feel like, done almost as much as, like, I don't even know, like a Jane Austen book.
The one I was watching was Elle Macpherson was in it.
Okay.
I don't know. It must have been like the 90s, maybe. I don't know.
Okay.
In the beginning of the book, she's sitting in the drawing room reading Bewick's History of British Birds. And so she lives with her aunt, Mrs. Reed, and her three cousins, Eliza, Georgiana, and John. Now, John is 14, and he's a bully, and he's awful. He torments her because she's a poor orphan. Like, he reminds her of that every day, that she is a poor orphan, and she only lives with the Reeds because his mother is so generous and kind, which is not true. In the first chapter, he throws a book at her, pushes her over the edge. She kind of explodes at him, and then she finally, like, fights back. Of course, Mrs. Reed blames her for everything that happens and sends her to the Red Room, which is extremely disturbing. So all of the people in the house, the servants, they avoid the Red Room because they all believe that it's haunted, because that is where her uncle had died, and that's where they'd laid his body for like days and days and days. Everybody in the house avoids this room, and she gets thrown in there as a punishment. And I think it's really, isn't it like totally dark?
Yeah, and they, of course, they completely blame her for the entire thing, which is just ridiculous. Something that I couldn't help thinking, though, was I have to wonder if J.K. Rowling took some inspiration from this for designing the whole unwanted nephew trope with Harry Potter. Because you have, I don't know, you read Harry Potter and you're like, how are people like this? Especially today. First of all, they totally are. But especially back in this time of Jane Eyre, this is something that would probably be very commonplace. It was not a big deal to punish children very severely, to tell children they're going to hell and to physically abuse them, and nobody's going to do anything about it. I kept thinking, this just reminds me so much of Harry Potter. So I had to think that maybe she drew some inspiration for it from this. So
I was listening to a podcast and the guy was talking about Charlotte Bronte, and he said, he was an author, and he said, you don't know how many times I'll like be writing and realize, oh, I just took that from Jane Eyre. So,
you know, fair enough. I think a lot between Jane Austen and the Bronte sisters, there's probably a lot in modern culture that can be traced back to them.
I would just not want to be in the Red Room. That is my biggest fear.
No, right? Oh my gosh. And she was terrified. Remember, she's a 10-year-old little girl who has never been shown love, because she is this where she talks about her past just a little bit?
Yeah, I think she learns about it.
Yeah. So she's in this Red Room, and Bessie and Miss Abbott take her in there, and they're like threatening to just tie her down if she doesn't stop, because she's resisting the whole way. She's like, I'm not going in there. And you can't blame her at all. But they're like, we're going to tie you down if you don't stop this. And they let her know, because she tries to tell him, like, this isn't fair. You know, this is what happened. Why am I being punished? And especially Abbott, but also Bessie. And this also speaks to sort of the mentality of the time. They're like, hey, guess what? You can't think for even a second that you are equal to those kids. Maybe you're their cousin, but you're not equal to them. You're kind of less than a servant in this house, because you don't do anything for your keep. You're not a blood relation to Mrs. Reed, because Jane is a blood relation, well, to her cousins, but also to Mrs. Reed's husband, who had passed away. I think it is in this chapter that we find out about her parents, but I'm just not seeing it. Like I said, I listened to it, and then I have the book in front of me to help remind me, but I'm just not.
It happens in chapter 3.
Oh, in chapter K, then I won't talk about that. But basically, Mr. Reed, her uncle, had brought her as a baby to the house. And she's pretty sure that if he was still alive, like, he would be treating her well, but he's not. And so this is her life. It's pretty awful. And it has been for close to 10 years, I believe, because I think he died pretty early on. Yeah, he'd been dead for 9 years. And that leads us to the part, like you said, when he died, he'd been laid in this chamber. And so people were pretty sure that his ghost was still there. And she thinks his ghost is still there, because they had not carried out his wishes in the way that they treated her, because she was certain that he wanted them to treat her well. They totally don't. So she's certain that his ghost is haunting the place. While she's in there, of course, just everything comes to her, and she's very terrified, and as it goes, when it's dark and when you're scared anyway, everything just seems amplified. And she sees this light, like this white light, I think on the top of the ceiling or something. And she is determined that it is a ghost. As you can imagine, when you're a little kid, you're not going to, heck, as an adult, I probably would think the same dang thing. There's not any room for rational thought when you're completely terrified. And so she just starts screaming and is like, let me out, let me out. Hysterical. So Bessie does come and she's like, are you sick? So they actually do take her to the nursery. And Mrs. Reed says that that is okay. I think she probably figures she's been punished enough. She actually, as they're taking her out, she loses consciousness. Impatient of my now frantic anguish and wild sobs, abruptly thrust me back and locked me in without further parley.
Yeah, doesn't she just scream, scream and scream and scream, and then she loses consciousness?
Yeah, but I thought that they had taken her into the nursery. But no, Mrs. Reed pushes her back into the red room and locks her in. And then in the next chapter, she does wake up in her own room.
Yeah, so she does. In chapter three, then she wakes up and she realizes that she's in her own room. Mr. Lloyd, who's the family's apothecary, is there. Now, if somebody important was sick, they would call a doctor. But because they don't care, he comes in to help her. Bessie is also there. And she, at this point, makes it really clear that she doesn't agree with how Mrs. Reed had treated her. Which Bessie's kind of like not... I get the feeling she's not horribly nice to her, and she kind of treats her as if, I mean, as Mrs. Reed does. But at this point, she's like, oh no, she shouldn't have done that. Should not have locked you up in that room. So she doesn't agree with that. So Jane stays in her bed the whole next day. Bessie like sings her a song. Mr. Lloyd talks to her about what her life is like at Gateshead, and she tells him. So he then suggests to her aunt, maybe you should send her away to school. And her aunt's probably like, yes, why didn't I think of that? This is a great idea. And so Jane, she's excited at the possibility of getting to leave Gateshead, but then she's also worried that it might not actually happen. So she's kind of apprehensive about getting excited. But she kind of recollects like what had happened in the Red Room and how awful it had been. She goes over it again. She does overhear a conversation between Bessie and Miss Abbott, where she learns that her mother had been a member of a wealthy family, like the Reed family, because they were wealthy. And they had disapproved of her marrying her father, who was a poor pastor, clergyman. And so when they got married, Jane's grandfather had written them off and written her out of his will. Then soon after Jane is born, her parents die from typhus. They had gotten that because Jane's father had been working with the poor. That's probably why Mrs. Reed gets this whole idea that she had married poor, and then this had caused him interacting with the poor is what had caused him to die. So
yeah,
Jane deserves everything she gets. This also reminds me a little bit of like Anne of Green Gables. I mean, her parents died of, I don't know, it was scarlet fever or something like that.
Yeah, it was something like that.
When she was just a baby, and then she's gets tossed around and doesn't have people that love her, and very similar. So, and we're, like we've said many times, we're reading so many books about orphans this year.
Yes, we really are, which is, it just kind of worked out that way.
Fine. Yeah.
Because even in Much Ado About Nothing, Beatrice is an orphan, which is why she lives with her uncle.
Yeah, we should go through and like figure it out. I'll go through and see if there's any books we're reading that I don't know about. The Old Man and the Sea. I don't know anything about that book.
Yeah, I don't know enough about that one.
And there's probably not an orphan in the Jane in Persuasion. Nope, there's no orphans in Persuasion. So never mind. But several of them.
In this chapter, she has quite the conversation with Mrs. Reed. She gets really brave because Mrs. Reed is telling her, you know, something I'm sure she said many times, like, don't talk to my children. And the kids would even say to her, you know, don't talk to us, whatever. And finally, Jane was like, no, they should not talk to me because what does she say? They are not fit to associate with me. And of course, Mrs. Reed is just horrified by this. She has the audacity to say, what do you think my Uncle Reed would think about the way that you're treating me? She's like, guess what? My parents and your husband, they can see what you're doing. You're going to be in trouble, you know?
I love this. I love that she's like just had enough and she just...
Yeah. And I think, and she knows that she's going to be leaving. She senses that. And so she's like, well, I'm going to leave him with a parting gift. You know, they will not forget me. Well, a little while later, she's summoned to talk to Mrs. Reed. And there is a man there. And she goes in to talk to her. And his name is Mr. Brocklehurst. He is just every nightmare. Well, what he makes me think of actually is like a Puritan minister or something, just somebody who is like so ridiculously pious. You're like, how can anyone even stand to be around you? He talks about his friend who has persuaded him to stay with him for a few weeks. And you're like, do you have friends? I think you're lying. I don't think anybody would actually want to be around you for that long. So he is the sort of director, master, whatever, of a place called Lowood School. And this is a school for young ladies. And he prides himself on the fact that everybody there, it's just all about very sharp discipline. He talks about how his wife and his daughter went and visited it. And his daughter's comment was that they were the most plain looking little girls with their, you know, their hair tucked behind their ears and their, what do they call them? Like Dutch pockets or something like that. The pockets of their aprons. And they're just very plainly dressed. They're very sober and somber. She says that they kind of marveled at the silks that she and her mom were wearing. And so he was very proud of that because he felt like he was like humbling the girls and teaching them their station and whatever, which is exactly what Mrs. Reed wants. And so I think the apothecary had good intentions, I think. And ultimately, this is the best thing for Jane. But I don't think this is quite what the apothecary had in mind. But it was left up to Mrs. Reed to find a suitable school. And so she found one where the headmaster was extremely strict, very puritanical, and just kind of insane. He sort of quizzes her a little bit and is like, are you a good little girl? Mrs. Reed tells him she's not a good little girl and that she lies and all this stuff. And he's like, well, don't you know that little girls that lie go to hell? And he's like, you should be concerned about your immortal soul. You could die any minute. And there, then where would you be? I love this. She's quite defiant because he says, like, do you know where the wicked go after death? They go to hell. And what is hell? A pit full of fire. And should you like to fall into that pit and to be burning there forever? No, sir. What must you do to avoid it? She deliberates for a moment and then she says, I must keep in good health and not die. She is coming into her own. She's very sassy, which is not an acceptable quality for a little girl or a grown girl at that point in time. But it ends up getting her good places ultimately. So he keeps after her about how she's so bad because she lies, whatever. Anyway, he leaves her with this little pamphlet that she's supposed to read so that she'll be aware of what happens to little girls that lie.
I think it's funny too, because this Mr. Brocklehurst, he just gets worse and worse too. Like, he's awful in this situation, but ugh.
No, he's bad. And when we get to Lowood School, like, it's going to get way worse for sure. It's almost unbelievable, but. Yeah. Just because so many authors of the time wrote things that were kind of similar about orphanages and schools of this nature, it does make you go, I think that actually is the truth. I think that that kind of thing really did happen. After he leaves, she has this conversation with Mrs. Reed, and I'm not going to go into it too much, but basically, again, she just kind of like gives her the what for. She says to Mrs. Reed, I'm glad you are no relation of mine. I will never call you aunt again as long as I live. I will never come to see you when I am grown up. And if anyone asks me how I liked you and how you treated me, I will say the very thought of you makes me sick and that you treated me with miserable cruelty. So she does have a good conversation with Bessie. We've talked about how Bessie is definitely kind of a victim of her time, where it's just like indoctrinated in them that you have a caste system and you've got the people at the top who are worth something. You've got the servants who are worth much less, but they're still worth something. And then you've got orphans and people with no money and no title and no right to anything. And they are just lower than dust. And so that's how Bessie seems to have been treating her. But apparently her mom came to visit and she was like, I wouldn't want any child of mine in this situation. So she actually had some nurturing feeling. And I think that that kind of helped Bessie go, yeah, you're not treated well at all. I do see that.
I love it. She says to Mrs. Reed, I am not deceitful. If I were, you know, you went into that. But then she says, this book about the liar, you may give it to your girl, Georgiana, for it is she who tells lies, not I.
Yeah.
I love that.
Again, yeah, she just tells it the way that it is, the way that she sees it. And it's like she's kind of had to be very silent for so long because she didn't know what was going to happen to her. But now she kind of knows.
Yeah. And then she says, deceit is not my fault. And she's like, well, you are passionate, I guess we could say that, which isn't a good thing either. But
no, not for a little girl.
Ugh. Unfortunately. Anyways, what a woman. In chapter 5, 4 days later, Jane gets on the 6 a.m. coach and travels to Lowood School all by herself. They just throw her on this coach. And when she gets to the school, so it's dark and rainy, and she finds out that her new home is also dark and dreary. And later on in the book, I think she says, like, it was awful there, but I was way happier here than at Gateshead. So, like, with all the comforts and lavish things they had there, this is better because she had no love. Nobody liked, you know, anyway. So it does end up better for her. The next day, Jane finds out, is introduced to her classmates and finds out what they do every day, that they're basically busy from dawn until dusk. They are kept busy. One thing after another. Miss Temple is the superintendent of the school, and she is very kind. But one of the teachers, Miss, is it Scattered? She's not kind. And she's especially unkind to this student named Helen Burns. And that is such an awful situation. Like, it doesn't matter what Helen does, she gets in trouble. So Jane and Helen end up becoming friends. Jane learns from her that Lowood is a charity school. And so basically the Reeds had paid nothing to put her there. And so the money to support all the girls comes from, I can't remember, like the community or something, or, you know, a church that donates money. And it's nothing, clearly not even enough to feed them. She also learns that Mr. Brocklehurst is the one that oversees everything. And even though Miss Temple is super nice and kind, she has to answer to him.
Yeah.
So she's, her hands are kind of tied when it comes to what the girls are allowed to have. And I did not like the situation with Helen Burns. Like, everything she does is wrong. It's awful.
Does it, I can't remember, does it describe what she looks like? I always thought she was supposed to be a very pretty little girl.
I think she has curly hair, but I'm not sure. Actually,
I only asked that because something I kind of forgot to mention was, Jane's reflecting earlier on at the Reed house, and she's like, basically, if I was a pretty little girl and just like minded my manners and things like that, then they would totally like me and this would not be an issue. But she is a plain little girl. She's not pretty and she's fiery and saucy, right? And so she has a difficult time. I feel like it might be the opposite where Helen is concerned, that she is a pretty little girl and she's sweet and everything. And so there's almost this jealousy, it seems like.
Maybe that's why they didn't like her.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Because they don't ever really give a reason that they don't like her.
Yeah.
I mean, she's sick. And I think they all know that she's sick.
Yeah.
The girl that has curly hair is not her. It's the Julia. One of the things they do is like they come in and the oatmeal, the porridge in the morning for breakfast is burnt. And it's like inedible. And the kids can't even stomach it. They like try to take a couple of bites and they can't. So they go back to class and they're just starving. And then Miss Temple orders like a decent lunch for them with like cheese and bread. And then that's when Mr. Brocklehurst learns about it later. And he's like, we can't do that. Even if the food isn't edible, I don't remember what he says, but it's like he wants them to be humble. And so things that are better than what they would normally get because something was so bad isn't acceptable. If that makes sense. Like they don't get luxuries because of that.
Cheese and bread, I wouldn't consider that a luxury, but
apparently it's better than
this guy.
Burnt porridge.
Yes.
Like you said, like there's so many books like this where it's like it's an orphanage and they barely get any food and they, or like it reminds me of like a concentration camp.
Oh yeah.
They get like a tenth of what they
barely
should.
Enough to survive, which is crazy.
It makes you wonder if when she was at her school, if that's how it was, she was starving.
If Charlotte, sorry, I'm just trying to look to see if there's any description of her, because it makes me super curious. But I'm not seeing any yet. I would imagine that that's where she drew it from, especially if people consider that this is maybe the closest thing we have to an autobiography for Charlotte Bronte. So the other thing this kind of reminds me of too is Matilda, because you've got, well, there's lots of comparisons, but you've got Miss Honey, who's like this lovely teacher and everything, but she also ultimately answers to the Trunchbull. And this one, you've got Miss Temple, who is very sweet and very good and does have the kids' best interests at heart, but she ultimately answers to Mr. Brocklehurst. So
but you look at these kind of stories and it's like you watch Matilda's parents and you're like, how could anybody behave like that? How could anybody treat a child like that? I mean, I know there are people in the world that do that kind of thing, but like, there's a lot of stories like
it's
that.
It's just wild. Yeah.
How do you starve people? How do you, you know, it's just like in my psychology class, we just learned how like in the 1700s and even probably the early 1800s, when people had mental illness, they thought they were possessed. One of the cures was to drill a hole in their head to let the demon out.
Yeah.
It's like, how did we treat people like that? And how did humans ever think that was okay? It's kind of unreal.
Another thing that would happen. Did you ever read the book 1000 White Women? That was a good book. It was about all the women that were sent to marry Native American men, because the thought was that that would like tame them type of thing, like sort of create this peace. So the story follows this one woman, May Dodd, and she was sent because her parents were like at their wits' end and she'd been like in a psych ward. Remember, this is also the 19th century. They'd put her in a psych ward because she kept being promiscuous and having premarital sex. And so in the psych ward, their solution was to take like really, really hot water and squirt it up her, you know?
That makes sense.
Right, definitely. That will take away the desire.
You know, we just learned about all these these insane asylums and like Bedlam, and they like chained people up.
Yeah.
Insane and unbelievable. Crazy. It's like, that's what this reminds me of.
Ooh. Crazy things that somehow somebody justified. And it makes you go, okay, what are we justifying today? That down the road, we're going to look back and go, what in the... So chapter 6. She is full-fledged into Lowood now. Well, I guess not full-fledged, but she's experiencing it. It's so cold, so cold. The water in the pitchers is frozen. They have this hour and a half of prayers and Bible reading. And I'm sorry, if there's any way to turn people off to a religious life, I think it is that exactly.
In the freezing cold.
In the freezing cold, and she talks about how she's never been so cold. The good thing was that their porridge was not burnt, so that's good, and was actually edible, but there was not very much of it. And like you mentioned before, it's like they live in a concentration camp or something, that they're like purposely almost starving the poor kids. Like it's really awful. She's enrolled in the fourth class. I think that for the most part, the teachers are pretty good, but there is this Miss Scatcherd who is pretty awful. And she seems to especially pick on one girl in particular who she calls Burns. And Burns cannot do anything right. Now, in her eyes, to everybody else, especially to Jane, she's like, Burns didn't do anything wrong. Why is she taking this, and why does she keep being punished? Miss Scatcherd gets after Burns for having dirty nails. And Jane is like, why doesn't she tell her that the water was frozen? Like there was nothing she could do about her nails. A little later, like they have this time that's sort of like a recess. She had had a conversation or had seen this girl before reading. I don't know that they'd had a conversation at that point. Oh, she had briefly had a conversation. Now she sees her reading and she says, is it still the same book? She says, Burns, yes, but she's just about finished. So she asks her what her name is. And her name is Helen. So Helen comes from the north of England, almost to Scotland. And I will say, just because I'm a huge fan of all the dialects and everything, the narrator that I'm listening to for this particular book does not do a good job of giving her a Northern English accent. I just love the Northern English accent. It's like kind of close to a Scottish accent, but not quite there. But she asks her, Jane asks Helen, she's like, why do you put up with this bad treatment? Like, she treats her so badly. And Helen's like, well, I deserve it. Like, I am slovenly, I am slatternly, whatever. And Jane is like, what? Like, there's no way. You seem like you're basically perfect. And Helen says, well, don't judge by appearances. But one thing that I will give to the narrator that I'm listening to is that she gives Helen a very, she seems very frail. You just listen to her voice and she gives her a very frail voice. And we learn that she is quite frail. She's kind of sickly. I think that she herself, she's incredibly intelligent. She's done a lot of introspection, a lot of deep thinking. She's also quite a bit older than Jane. She's about 14. She just gives her a lot of wisdom. They have this kind of long conversation. I wanted to bring this part out. Jane says to her, I must dislike those who, whatever I do to please them, persist in disliking me. I must resist those who punish me unjustly. It is as natural as that I should love those who show me affection or submit to punishment when I feel it is deserved. So basically, she's holding to a truth that most of us do. Like, when people just are mean to us, no matter what we do, we kind of, it's in our nature to at least kind of dislike them. You know, they're not going to be our favorite people. What Helen says is, that's something that heathens and savages would believe, but Christ teaches differently. He says, your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you and despitefully use you. And Jane, as she always is quite frank and a little bit defiant. And she says, well, then I should love Mrs. Reed, which I cannot do. I should bless her son, John, which is impossible. But I love, because I think it's so incredibly relatable. And so it's a really brilliant, beautiful thing that Charlotte Bronte does, because through Jane, we have also come to really not like Mrs. Reed and to really not like John Reed. But then Helen, it's sort of like a smack in the face. Yeah, but Jesus says that's what we're supposed to do, is to love our enemies and bless them that curse us. And we go, wait, really? It sounds so easy, but it's not. It also comes back to what C.S. Lewis said in his book, though, which I find a lot of comfort in, when he was like, really, a lot of that means you don't wish them ill. You wish them good things, you know, which is in our human condition a lot easier to do than a lot of things. So anyway,
she gives some amazing, like you said, amazing advice, amazing like thoughts insane that she's had. Yeah. I mean, she is wrong in that, you know, Miss Scatcherd believes that she's bad and she's not. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, she does not deserve to be treated that way. And that is incorrect. Good grief.
She's brainwashed into thinking that there's something wrong with her. But I really do like what she says about, it's far better to endure patiently a smart which nobody feels but yourself than to commit a hasty action whose evil consequences will extend to all connected with you. So she's kind of like being the savior. Like, hey, I can take it. If I get kicked out of this school and I go home, it's going to affect everybody else at home. It's better for me just to like keep the pain here, take whatever they have to give me. Anyways, and then I like what Jane says. She says, still, I felt that Helen Burns considered things by a light invisible to my eyes. She's like, I can't see it.
Yeah, which she does, because she's extremely mature and she's done, like I said, just all of this deep thinking. She's very wise. But in the thing where, you know, she expects this behavior from herself, but she does not expect these adults to treat her fairly. So there is a bit of a disconnect for sure. It's like, yes, that is what Christ teaches. And it would not be okay with him that they are treating you like this.
Right. So she's got half
of it. You
don't
have to put up. Right. Jesus bore a lot, but there were some things he did not put up with, and he would not have put up with that. So,
Yeah. I just thought she was super smart in here.
Yeah.
So in chapter 7, for the first month at Lowood, like, Mr. Brocklehurst isn't really around very much. He brought her there, but he hasn't kind of reappeared. When he does come to visit, Jane's like, uh-oh, that she remembered that Mrs. Reed had told him that she was a liar. He was supposed to warn all the teachers about her, and he hadn't done that yet. So she had had this whole month where she was like proving herself or whatever, you know, showing them who she was. And they didn't know what he knew. So when he's there, she's kind of trying to like hide her face with her slate. Like she doesn't want him to notice her.
Don't recognize me.
Yeah, she's got it in front of her face. And then she accidentally drops it, which then it breaks. So now he's looking at her. Anyway, so he yells at her and then he makes her stand on this stool while he then tells the whole school that she's a liar. He tells the other students not to speak to her for the rest of the day. The one like saving grace is that Helen kind of will like sneak smiles to her throughout the day, which makes her feel a little bit better about what's going on with standing on the stool and being humiliated. And this is the chapter where he gets mad at the girls. One of the girls has naturally curly hair. And he's like, he says, "What's up with that girl with the curly hair?" And Miss Temple's like, "Well, her hair does that naturally." And he's like, "I don't care.
Like, cut it off.
We're not into..." Oh, and another interesting thing, which I didn't put in there. Yeah. "We're not into anything above like humble, straight, like can fix this." The other interesting thing is his daughter and his wife are there, or two of his daughters and his wife, and they are dressed like to the nines. They have silk dresses.
Well, all these other girls are like starving and made to really be humiliated in every way.
And it just goes on and on and on about these, the woman and her daughter and their looks and how their hair is curled and how it's styled and how their dresses look. And then you've got him yelling at the girl with naturally curly hair that she can't do anything about.
And I think that he wanted all of them to have their hair cut short.
Yeah, didn't he want to like, he's like, cut it all off.
Because he saw these top knots, I think, like buns, basically. And I was like, they shouldn't have buns.
It's a waste of time. It's a waste of resources. Somebody told me the other day that they shaved their head for something. And they were like, "That's the best thing I ever did." I'm like, it was a woman. I was like, yeah, it might have been easy, but I would not look good without hair.
Oh, me neither. And I'm sorry. I like my hair. I like my hair. So yeah, I could not do that. It's one of those things. I don't mind taking care of my hair at all.
So I don't have very much hair, but I do sometimes wear my hair in a ponytail. And then I have this like these, I think I've told you this, these headphones that wrap around my head. And my kids are like, they can't stand it when I wear it because it looks like I have no hair.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And they're like, "Mom's wearing her cancer patient headphones," which might be offensive. I don't know. But they say I look like a cancer patient when I have those on. When I cut my hair shorter, I don't put it in a ponytail. I wear my hair so you can see my hair coming out of them. So it doesn't traumatize them.
Yeah. That's funny. You may have to wear it sometimes so I can see what it looks like.
Yeah, it's just like if you had a beanie on and your hair was like in a ponytail, like I just look like I don't have hair. And so the kids are disturbed.
There's this girl that comes to the gym. And I commented to somebody the other day, I was like, she is one of very few people who can pull off a pixie cut. Cause she's gorgeous. And I'm like, get out of here. You're just kind of shaming the rest of us. She's just beautiful. But not the cut of her face, just the shape of her face is such that she has this very short cropped hair and it totally works for her. But the person that I commented that to was like, well, she actually used to be bald. He's like, yeah, she used to have like this long, luxurious hair. And then she came in one day and was completely bald. One of the guys who works front desk, he was like, what happened to your hair? I was like, dude, okay, shut up. Because you don't know. I mean, maybe she was having a chemo treatment. Nobody really knows, but this is her hair growing back. It looks adorable. She looks very cute.
Clearly, I can't pull it off, but other people can. And some people look really good.
But not very many. Not very many women look good with super short hair. The ones who do, they really do. Like, there's just no way. I've never tried it. And I never will. Okay, so chapter 8, Jane has to stand on this stool for like 30 minutes. And like you say, everybody's told to not talk to her the rest of the day. Of course, Helen does. She's feeling so sad and so bad. And she's like, everybody's going to despise me And Helen's like, everybody is a lot of people. There's like millions of people in the world. Nobody even knows that. And Jane is like, well, the 80 people that are here, it may as well be the entire world. You know, Helen's like, nobody's going to despise you. Nobody likes Mr. Brocklehurst. And so whatever he does, everybody's like, whatever, you know, because he does it to everybody, really. She's like, people may act like it at first just because they have to sort of do whatever he says, but nobody is going to think badly of you. You know, nobody hates you. So anyway, this just really comforts her and helps her and really draws her closer to Helen. They go and visit Miss Temple. Miss Temple sits down and talks to them for a long time. And something that they tell her, that Jane tells her, is that she's like, I'm not a liar. And she like tells the entire story. She mentions Mr. Lloyd, the apothecary. And Miss Temple is like, I know Mr. Lloyd. I'm going to write to him. She's like, I already believe you, so I know you're not a liar, but I'm going to basically get you off the hook with everybody else because we're going to get word from Mr. Lloyd that like you're truthful, you know? It's about clearing her name in front of everybody. So Miss Temple says she's going to do that. So, and while they're there, she actually also feeds them a seed cake because all they'd had for dinner was like bread and water or something, which let's starve the children because that's a good idea. Anyway, they have this sweet and good conversation with Miss Temple. We love her. And it's evident that Miss Temple really, she loves the girls, but she has a special fondness for Helen. She's just really special to her. As they leave, she says, God bless you, my children. She says, when they get back to their rooms, Miss Scatcherd is like investigating their drawers. And she says that Helen's drawers are very disordered. And Helen's like, yes, they are disordered because I meant to go back and, you know, fold things and reorder them. And then I forgot to. And so the next day, Miss Scatcherd, I'm just going to read this so I don't get it wrong. Miss Scatcherd wrote in conspicuous characters on a piece of pasteboard the word slattern and bound it like a phylactery round Helen's large, mild, intelligent, and benign-looking forehead. She wore it till evening, patient and resentful, regarding it as a deserved punishment. That's crazy. But this is what they put up with. But at the end of this chapter, I do think it's interesting because I think that simply because of the friendships that she has formed with Helen, with Miss Temple, and there's really quite a few very good people there. She says, I would not now have exchanged Lowood with all its privations for Gateshead and its daily luxuries, which I think is very telling because at the end of the day, humans need good relationships more than they need all the luxuries. Yeah. If you can have both, that would be great. But
that is the best.
You can only have one. It's about the relationships.
That's true. I mean, I just think about like being loved is, and loving somebody is probably the most important thing that humans need. That's interesting.
Yeah.
I have all these like thoughts from my psychology class quiz.
I'm sure. Please share.
Like the higher, is it Maslow's hierarchy of needs?
Yeah.
Like you've got, once your basic needs are taken care of, which I mean, in this situation, they kind of were. They had a place to stay and sort of had food. Then you can worry about love and connection. And they say too, once your basic needs are like fulfilled, you don't, those extra things don't add as much. You know what I mean? Does that make sense?
Yeah. It's like, there is so, so much value in those basic needs and then sort of diminishing value.
There you go.
More like, luxury.
That was much, much more eloquent than what I was trying to, like how I was trying to say it. But yeah, then it just doesn't add as much.
Yeah. Yeah.
The value diminishes. Sense. So therefore, like the relationships and the love come in as higher value than extra things. And
yeah, for sure.
Anyway, yeah, I always think like if I'm not hungry, I'm good.
Oh, there's so much you can put up with when you're not hungry. And when you are hungry, there's very little you can put up with.
So David was watching this YouTube video the other day, and they were doing science, well, like a study. And the sentences that judges give out to criminals are directly tied to when the last time they ate was.
I totally believe that. That's super interesting. Wow.
So if you are going to jail, pray that your judge just ate.
Yeah. Yeah. Seriously. Or if you want to make sure somebody gets like the worst sentence, like restrict the judge's food
You
for
want to
like
come in
hours.
fasting.
Yeah. Seriously.
Well, I thought
That's
that was
super
really
interesting.
funny. I would hope that their judgment in what they should do should not be tied to when they ate last.
Well, it totally shouldn't, but at the same time, judges are totally human.
Yeah, it's crazy.
That is crazy.
Which just makes me think, like, if I'm rude to you, ask me when the last time I ate was. We do that with, like,
I'll remember that, but you have never been rude to me, so.
no, with Katie, though, we would tell her boyfriends, we'd be like, keep her fed. If she gets to the point where she's hungry and it gets like past that, you're in trouble and you can't really go back from it. Like, you can feed her
Yeah.
and then it's too late still.
No, like really, Peter.
She's the most like hangry child we have.
I think most of my kids are totally that way, but definitely Addie is at the top. It's like anything off gets her crazy. Today, there was the threat of an active shooter on the SUU campus. And our town is small enough that that can affect everything, right? And it does. Every single school was on lockdown. Helicopters circling the campus. Every single policeman and sheriff were there at the campus. The entire campus was shut down. Like every building, it was like nobody leaves. They told the National Guard to be on standby. So anybody local, right? And so Addie, being in the National Guard and being fully trained, she's like, okay. So she got on her uniform and she just had to kind of wait and see if they were called in. They never were. I think they had SWAT in there first and all kinds of other things, and they figured it out. Like the rest of the day, she was just, oh my gosh, just kind of awful. Like so just mean and unreasonable and everything. And so I think that that stress, thinking that she might actually have to go in and do what
Do
she's been trained to
something.
do. Yeah. It was like, and
I
just
would
put
be
her over
like
the
that
top.
too.
Yeah.
We have Life 360, which is like tracks where
Yes.
all of our family is. We got a text message that said, Amanda may have been in an accident. The app detected like strong braking. You might want to
Oh,
call her.
wow.
That's happened when I got in my car accident a year or a little bit more than a year ago. My kids got texts that said I'd been in an accident. And I was like, this isn't
Wow.
good because I was fine, but they're like freaking out. And then they
Yes.
can't get a hold of you because you're busy. I could see on the app that where Amanda was and that she wasn't moving. I knew she'd gotten in an accident. And my mom and my dad and her husband were going towards her. And
Okay.
I was like, why are they all going? All of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyways, I was shaking. I was a nervous wreck until I finally got a hold of my dad, and he had been sent to pick up the kids from school because that's where she was going. And he's like, well, she was standing outside the car, so I think she's okay. And I mean, her car's totaled. A lady, like, she was going down the highway, and a lady tried to cross the highway and didn't see her. And so she hit her and like spun her car around.
Oh
And
my
she, of
gosh.
course, had the like her 3-year-old was in the car, and I just like, oh my gosh. But
Oh my gosh. So it was pretty bad, but everybody came out okay.
yeah, they had to go to the hospital, but they said they were fine. I just am like, that just threw me off. You know, the feeling of like, is everything okay?
Like
What
very
happened?
stressed and unknown, and probably nobody's picking up their phones right away
Yeah.
and things like that.
But
Yeah.
they're all okay. And I don't like that. Don't text me and tell me somebody got in a car accident.
Seriously. Tell me afterwards. Well, and I think that's actually kind of interesting that you bring that up because that directly correlates with some other things that happened today. Like, because all the SUU students were getting these like every 15-minute updates, but in some ways it was like making
Worse.
it worse. It was because it was like there were sounds of shots being fired in the science building. And we're all like, oh my gosh, because I'm at work. A lot of the kids who work at Vasa are like in college and they're studying sciences. Like that's what they do, you know? And so we're like trying to do a head count. We're trying to, you know, track down everybody and see where they're. And all the students who were there, they're like, okay, well, we're not in there, but we're in the building right next to it. And they're freaking out, going, oh my gosh, this is happening. Find out later, there were no shots fired. Somebody, I don't even know where that came from. So yeah, there were some things it was like, don't say it till you really, really, really know.
Tell me afterwards when everybody's okay. That's scary. I don't like those situations. And like you
Yeah.
said, sometimes less information is better. I mean, if you could do something,
If you can do something, but when it's like there's no actionable items here.
Yes.
So what do? Just sit and be scared. That's all.
Oh, anyways, that's crazy. Last chapter for today. It's spring. And so Lowood seems happier and it's warmer, but because of that, they are having problems with typhus. And more than half the girls have it. It's kind of funny because they're like they're not watched as closely because they can't be, because half the girls are sick. And so they kind of have more freedom than they would normally.
Yeah.
So Jane doesn't end up getting it, and she spends a lot of time outside with her new friend, Marianne Wilson. And I kind of liked what she said in there, like, well, what happened to Helen? Like, I'm not just ignoring her. So
Yeah.
I thought that was kind of a
promise I didn't forget about her.
Funny way of putting that in there. And what happened to her is Helen is sick. She doesn't have typhus, so she doesn't have what all the other girls have. But Jane does find out that Helen is dying of consumption and that she had been staying in Miss Temple's rooms. Like you said, Helen was special to Miss Temple, and Miss Temple knew that she was dying. And so
yeah,
she was very kind to her. So one night, then Jane ends up sneaking into her room because she says, I have to talk to her. I have to talk to her and say goodbye before she passes on. She goes in there and Helen is so sweet and says, you know, dying of consumption really isn't that bad. It's gentle.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. This part made me cry.
Yeah. It's a great way to die. And she's like, I'm kind of just happy to go. It's fine. And so Jane ends up like curling up with her and getting warm. And Helen asks her not to leave. It's so sad. And so they just fall asleep. And then in the morning, Miss Temple finds them and Helen is dead. Luckily, I don't think Jane wakes up to that. They remove
No.
her.
Right.
And so she wakes up as they're like carrying her off to her own room, probably. But and then at the end, too, it's like her grave was originally unmarked, but then like 15 years later, they added a marble tablet. Jane probably put the marker on her grave and it had one word on it, resurgum. Do you think that's how you say it in Latin? Or would it be resurgum?
I think it's resurgum. I don't think there's a j sound.
Which is Latin for I shall rise again. So that's a good place to leave off, actually. It's so sad. I can't imagine like curling up with somebody and waking up and they're dead.
No, especially like in Jane's situation, it's just exponentially sadder because this is the first real friend that she's had. And she's just so, I want to say she's probably more like a big sister at this
Yeah.
point because she's so wise and she's so loving. She takes care of her. She gives her advice. She's just there for her. And Jane has never had that. And so, and then she's taken from her so just quickly and awfully. And it is very sad.
So next week, we'll do chapters 10 through 16. Have you had any time to read?
Mm-mm.
That's okay.
It's not okay. It makes me very sad.
I don't want to cut this segment out of our podcast. I've been working really hard on it, though. Like, I try to make sure I read at least a book a week, but.
Which, that's amazing. Like, at this point in my life right now, I'm like, that's incredible. It's okay. How would I fit that in? I don't know.
Well, you're sleeping. You know, turn it on while you're sleeping. So what I read, actually, it was last week, was Hidden Potential by Adam Grant. And it was really good. I liked it. It's nonfiction about, it says, we live in a world that's obsessed with talent. We celebrate gifted students in schools, natural athletes in sports, and child prodigies in music. But he was just kind of looking at like, that's not what really matters in success. It's like our effort. And we underestimate how good at something we can become. Like, oh, a couple of interesting things were, you know, they say that you can really learn a language so much easier as a child, right? Which is true. Mm-hmm. But we can also learn languages as adults. And he figured out that the key to learning a language as an adult is to be vulnerable and make mistakes and be willing to like put yourself out there and practice.
Yeah.
And that's how you do it. So anyways, and like just how to like take the mistakes we make and like use them to learn. I really liked it. It kind of was good for me, like with school. Sometimes I feel like school is, even though I haven't found a class I couldn't do yet, I always feel like the next one is the one I won't be able to do.
You're doubting yourself, Laura. Don't doubt yourself.
I know. I just took the psychology class I just took was the hardest class I've ever taken, ever. Took the most time. It was so hard, but I did it.
You've done it. Yeah.
And I got 95% in the class.
Oh my gosh.
I didn't take the final because I didn't have
to. I know. That it goes back to that part of like, yeah, just not doubting yourself, being able to.
I worked so hard all semester that I was like, oh, I have my grades high enough that I don't even have to take the final. So I
that
didn't.
is incredible. It really is.
Anyways, but yeah,
That's
I'm always
awesome.
Like, the next one, it's the one that's going to get me and prove that I'm an imposter.
Oh my gosh. No way. Holy cow. First of all, that book sounds awesome. And it makes me totally think of the book Grit by Angela Duckworth. I feel like they're very closely related because she talks about like all of her research was based around like how far does talent get you without the hard work? The conclusion is not very far. Talent only takes you to a certain point. And a lot of times it's the people who are very talented who do not learn to have grit. They don't learn that they need to put in the extra hard work. And so when the hard times come, things like she specifically studied the kids who go to, oh my gosh, West Point, very, very difficult military school. And like, there were so many kids who got there because they were able to breeze through high school. They did have all this natural talent. And so they had the amazing grades. There were these incredible athletes, all these things. And then they get to West Point and it was like, that wasn't enough. They needed to learn the hard work. So it's the kids who had to work their butts off in high school that did well. Yeah.
Amazing.
And there's so many people that we look at and we're like, oh my gosh, they're so talented. They're so incredible. And you dig into their stories and you realize actually they're not. They're incredible. Yes. But natural talent, not necessarily. Grit and hard work. Because they do have that potential, they had to put in the work.
Yeah. I like books like that. So it was kind of helpful
mm-hmm.
to read. And I see Sydney in that. She had to learn how to fight through her disabilities and she came out on top of everybody else because of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
incredible.
I can see it right up front here.
Yeah.
In front of me.
Yeah. We're so happy you joined us for this episode. We hope you will join us next week as we discuss Jane Eyre chapters 10 through 16. If you have suggestions for books we should read and discuss, please email us at thebestbookspodcast@gmail.com. We would love it if you would leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts and share our podcast with your friends. We want to inspire and encourage as many people as we can to read out of the best books.
As Thoreau says, read the best books first, or you may not have a chance to read them at all. See you next week.